When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And if your right hand offends you, cut it off, cast it from you. For it is profitable that one of your members should perish.
And not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. Matthew 5:29-30. Woodbury had a damn fine library.
Hey Zed Heads, welcome to the podcast. I'm Jason.
And I'm Rachel.
Rachel, and this is the Cast of Us episode 597.
And this episode, we're covering The Walking Dead season 3, episode 11, I Ain't a Judas.
I ain't a Judas. Do you say ain't usually? Probably
never.
You never say ain't.
Never am.
You just did. I forced you. This is Rachel. It's not Lucy, by the way, in case you
Hello.
Guys didn't realize. Welcome to the show, Rachel. Lucy's
Thank
out
you.
This week. Rachel's graciously agreed to step in. You may have realized Rachel is the same Rachel that's been sending in these amazing messages during Aww. The rewatch. So happy to have you on.
Thank you so much. This is such an honor. I'm so excited.
You've been around for a long time. You've been a listener since way, way back. And I don't know exactly when, but I wanted to ask you first, like, when did you start watching The Walking Dead and how did that go? And then how did you find the podcasts?
So I actually came to The Walking Dead pretty late because I hate when people go crazy over a show. And so I was very resistant mm-hmm. to jump on the bandwagon. And then my brother started watching it and convinced me that I needed to also like get on the bandwagon. So, I think I started actually horribly in season 6.
Oh, wow. That long, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just started watching it right then at first? Didn't go back to the beginning?
No. It was currently in season 6. Mm-hmm. I started all the way from the beginning.
Okay.
Pretty much, yeah, binged it over a couple of months. And then I think it was because Glenn was under the dumpster.
Mm-hmm.
And then if that was the mid-season finale, I think I started watching live.
I can't remember when that was. I don't think it was because I remember, well, maybe it was.
I actually don't
think
it was.
Did we have to
wait
that long? No, because I think it happened and then there was an episode. The
that
next week
sense.
That didn't say anything about Glenn. And then the next week after that, we found out he was under
okay,
the dumpster.
Okay, yeah, so that's true. They then. Made us wait for a while.
Yeah, a couple of weeks. Okay. I remember that because James, you know, Walker Stalker James, I was doing mm-hmm. the whole convention thing. And he wrote to me and said, because we were doing panels with, I think, Stephen Yeun, like the coming weekend. And he said,
wow.
It appears Glenn dies in this week's episode. And I thought he was saying, Glenn's dead. You know, like it appears he's dead and not, you know, the appearance is that he's dead, but he's not really. So I was like, oh my God, I just got a text saying one of my favorite characters is dead. And you just said it so casually.
Horrible.
God,
you gotta prepare me for these things. What
but
the hell?
I'm glad I didn't realize what he was saying, because then it would have been even more of a spoiler, you know?
Totally. Yeah.
Anyway, that's funny. So, and then what about the podcast? What, like, did you find us pretty quick after that?
Or? I think a few months later, because I pretty immediately became obsessed with the show and wanted to talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And nobody wanted to talk about it with me all the time, including my brother.
That's our bread and butter, people who don't have anyone to talk about it with.
Yeah, right. It's like my favorite pastime, which is why I'm so happy to be here and just indulge in it for a bit. But I think a few months after I started watching, because I was living in New York City when I started watching, moved back to Buffalo, and I was like, I need an outlet for this. And I searched around a little bit. And I think you guys have talked about this before. Other podcasters were just really negative. And
one in particular.
Okay.
It's Bald Move, who are friends of mine, and I think they're great. But they covered the market of the people who like to hate watch The Walking Dead.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. So did not enjoy that. And then just happened upon you and Karen and absolutely loved it. And actually went back and looked at my emails. And the first time I sent in an email was like December of 2016. So
what's that? 8 years ago.
8 years. Yeah. Crazy.
Man. Yeah. I can't believe like a long time ago is still more than halfway through the series at this point.
Yeah.
It's been so long.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad that we're like, this is your first time coming on. So it's been a long time coming, and it's, let's get into it. It's Walking Dead season 3, episode 11. I Ain't a Judas. The wiki says, and you probably already were going to talk about this, but we talk about the title usually early on. So the title, I Ain't a Judas, refers to Carol telling Andrea to kill the governor while he's sleeping and her inability to betray him the same way Judas betrays Jesus in the Bible. And I thought, that's misleading because Andrea would never say ain't either. Daryl would, right?
And yeah, Daryl Merle. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And I wondered if maybe Carl, maybe, but I don't know if Carl would be like, I ain't a Judas, Dad. But maybe that was a deliberate misdirection so the title wouldn't give the ending away, you know?
Yeah.
You wouldn't think that Andrea would say that.
I know, yeah. I was thinking about it going in like, does somebody say this in the episode? It's such weird phrasing, but no.
Yeah, I didn't hear it. Maybe we have a live Steve. Yeah, he always says when they say the title, so he'll let us know for sure when we get to that. Let me read the plot summary, and then we'll get into it. So it says, in the wake of the governor's attack, the survivors begin to crumble. Herschel scolds Rick into resuming leadership. Merle struggles to fit in. It sounds like a high school movie. Andrea travels to prison to negotiate peace, but they refuse. Carol persuades Andrea to kill the governor, but she decides against it. Tyrese leads his group to Woodbury. So how did you find watching this one in particular in general?
I actually enjoyed it way more than I thought I would.
Me too.
I couldn't remember really what happened in the episode. And then I think I read the summary on Netflix or something, and I was like, oh no, are we just going to be shitting on Andrea the entire time?
Yeah.
But no, like I, despite her and all of that, I actually enjoyed the prison scenes and like really liked the episode. So pleasantly surprised.
Me too. I keep saying this, but I remember not liking the second half as well. And I'm liking it much better now. And I don't know if that's because I think in part we've gotten better at really getting under the surface of the episodes than maybe we were back then. And yeah, I think maybe back then it was more just like, Andrea's the worst. Why do we have to watch her or something? Right. I don't know. But I wouldn't say I feel sympathetic towards Andrea more, but I do I feel like I understand her more, and I can understand where she's coming from. Some of the impulses I actually admire, and then some I don't admire, but I can understand. And I might have felt similar things in my life before and then regretted it later, you know? So, so it's an interesting watch, I think. And I think, anyway, I mean, I think for the most part, her heart's in the right place, which helps me a lot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't been very sympathetic to her and haven't really seen things as you have seen them in the past few episodes, but I agree. Her heart is in the right place. Sometimes she's like very contradictory and, you know, we'll get into it, but
yeah, we will. But I think in a way, contradictory in a way that's human and not like bad writing, think. But we might disagree about Andrea a little bit here, which is totally fine. Okay. That'll make it more interesting. All right. So why don't you start off with your first point?
Okay. So I wanted to, I titled my first point Prison Stuff and Things because I wanted to check in on everybody in the prison since the cold open starts us off there. And just kind of like see, check in with everybody. Where's everybody at mentally?
Not too far to go physically.
Yeah.
It's like that one cell block.
Yeah, exactly. With maybe a heavy focus on Merle. But
yeah,
because
he's the new one.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Like, we start in the same spot. Like, it's almost a parallel scene to one from last week. But Rick's there, Daryl's back, and Merle's with them. Mm. And so the dynamic has totally shifted. I like how everybody sort of pipes up with their own input at first, kind of everybody disagreeing a little bit
about what to do about the governor.
Yeah. Yeah. Rick says, we're not leaving. Herschel says, we can't stay here. Maggie's concerned about another sniper not being protected. Beth says, we can't even go outside. Carol, which I thought was funny, said, not during the daylight. Glenn sticks with Rick and says, if Rick says we're not running, we're not running. And then Merle pipes up, just so unhelpful. And I mean, okay, I'm a little conflicted about this because he is telling them like the raw truth about the governor, and like that was just him ringing the doorbell. You know, we should have left last night. Basically, like, we're all screwed now. He could just starve us out if he wanted to.
Yeah.
I'm like, this isn't helpful, but it is the truth. So is this Merle trying to be helpful, or is he just trying to be a dick? I don't know. I can't tell.
I mean, yeah, like, I was thinking about Merle a lot too, because the question is, should they allow him to stay or not? And
yeah.
I think with Merle, you have to do your best to ignore the assholery part and then take the rest that's useful, you know? And so the digs and all that, just whatever. Okay, whatever. But what information do you have? How can you help us achieve our goals? And I think he knows the governor. He knows the governor's tactics, capabilities, and also I think he'll be honest because he's loyal to Daryl, and the governor is now, he knows the governor well enough to know, oh, I betrayed him. There's no coming back from that. He's going to try to kill me. So he doesn't have any motivation to lie. He will be an asshole no matter what, but also I just think that he can be very useful in this moment. And then once they get out of this sticky situation, they can figure out whether they want to keep him as a friend or not, you know?
Right.
That's what
for what he's worth.
Yeah. But it's hard for Glenn to come to that because he tortured Glenn and tried to kill him with a zombie while Glenn was tied to a chair and all that.
Yeah. I mean, so we have Glenn and Maggie who are still basically furious and emotional, understandably, but, you know, Glenn calling him a snake in the nest, basically saying we need to just turn him over to the governor and see if we can basically come to a deal with the governor by turning Merle over. But
Merle's not going to be like, any deal
not,
point.
No, I'm like, Glenn, you're not thinking. You're using your emotional mind, not your wise mind here. It's not
Yes,
gonna work.
Exactly. Yeah, it really is.
And like, even Maggie, like, this is all you. You started this. And I really appreciated Beth's response to that. She says, what's the difference whose fault it is? What do we do?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm finding in the rewatch that Maggie tends to be like the emotional sister. And like, we all know she has this fire in her. Mm-hmm. But at least in these beginning seasons, I'm finding she's like reactive and emotional. And Beth comes in with like sort of the reasonable. I mean, now.
She can always be like that. You know, now that you're saying this, it makes me want to keep an eye on Maggie, because the one thing that popped in my head is when she went and killed Gregory.
Right.
You know?
Oh my gosh. I was so shocked.
So maybe that's how she is.
Yeah, right. Something interesting to track again. Yeah. So, okay. I was going to talk about Rick being outside. Rick, like, not very present in this episode. Like, in this, we're talking about the opening scene. He starts to walk away. Herschel screams at him, which, like, iconic Herschel moment. Get back here.
It was interesting because last week we saw Herschel trying to meet Rick. Where is that? Be sympathetic.
Yeah.
You know, gentle. And now he's like, well, that didn't work. So right. The gloves are off. Like, dude,
yeah.
I trust in my family with you. Mm-hmm. You need to get it together. And he didn't give any consequences, but then I mean, you're going to talk about Carl, but Carl kind of gave the consequence. Like, why don't you just leave it up to Herschel and Daryl, dad?
Yeah.
But I like that Herschel did that. I thought it was great.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like a slap in the face that maybe Rick needed that, mm-hmm. you know, isn't always helpful for someone going through a mental health crisis, but it's the apocalypse and we don't have time for counseling. So.
Yeah. And he tried the counseling.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Fair point. Yeah.
And Rick's the one insisting on leading. So he's going to have to do the job if he wants the job.
No, exactly. You know? I love the callback. You once said this isn't a democracy. Mm-hmm. Like, yep. Yeah. And then Carl going outside, like you just mentioned, maybe you should step down. Carl's so stoic and cold in this episode. And now that I'm thinking about it, his presence is a little bit like Michonne's. He's just kind of standing there observing everybody and doesn't weigh in a lot. But this is like a super powerful weigh in by Carl. Yeah. Don't get mad at me, Dad, but I don't think you should lead anymore.
Yeah. And he says you deserve a rest.
And yeah, totally I mean, true.
Yeah, like he just saw his dad have a mental breakdown.
Yeah.
And he sees that people aren't happy with, like, he's not really stepping in and giving direction. And so he's saying the pretty clearly reasonable thing to say, which is maybe you should just take a break for a little while and let these guys handle it who are kind of needing some direction and seem to have some ideas of their own, you know.
It makes right, sense yeah.
to me. But Rick seemed offended and he didn't really address it and he didn't take his advice.
Yeah. I was wondering what you made of that look on his face. He seemed like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah.
Who do you think you are?
You said you would get mad, Dad. It seemed like he was offended to me, but
I know it did. Yeah. I was like, I think he looks pissed. Like, what? Yeah. So then there's sort of the Merle of it all, which is the bigger part of this point. I don't know if you had anything to add about anybody else.
Not right now. I might okay. later.
So Herschel and Merle in the prison cell, that that scene. So Herschel walks in, calls him the black sheep. They have like a little sort of like friendly back and forth, and then he pulls out his Bible and quotes Matthew chapter 5.
I'm glad you're on for this one because you're pretty religious, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you might be a little more in tune with, because this episode had a few references.
Yeah. Okay, good. I'm glad that you're on board with me breaking this down a little bit.
Fully. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So not to be nitpicky, but it was actually just Matthew chapter 5, verse 30.
Why they do that? I think that was not supposed to be a slight on Merle. I think it was a fault in the writing. What the hell?
Yeah, totally.
Why would they bother having him be wrong like that? That's
dumb. I know. Yeah, I was surprised when I saw it. But okay, I'm gonna read just more of like a normal English version. So I'll read verses 29 and 30. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Okay, so I realized just last night after watching this like 3 times that on surface level, he used this verse because Merle has lost his hand. And so it seems applicable in that way.
And Herschel lost his leg.
True that. Yep.
Too. Yeah. So it's like, and both of them, I mean, the verse is saying better to lose a part of something than the whole thing, if that's the alternative, basically. Right. And that's the case for both of them. If Merle hadn't cut off his hand, the zombies would have killed him. If Rick hadn't cut off Herschel's leg, then he would have become a zombie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like,
so that's the literal,
it like bonds them
parallel yeah. to that verse.
Right. Right.
Yeah, they connected like two guys connecting over their pretty peculiar circumstances.
Right. I just think so. There's just a much bigger meaning too. Like the verse is actually saying, so it's Jesus speaking in the Gospel of Matthew, and he's saying, make better choices, basically. Short-term pain for long-term gain. Like it's actually in a section about adultery, but like the right eye meaning is referencing like lust. So throw your lust away. Like it's not going to be gratifying in the moment, but there'll be a longer term reward.
Mm.
Your right hand, greedy, power hungry people, you know, cut that off, throw it away. Won't be rewarding mm-hmm. in the short term here and now, but longer
term. To save your soul, basically.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I just think, so I'm reading into it thinking, is this also Herschel's way of telling Merle not to be a dick and to make better choices?
I think so, yeah. Like, see, now I'm so glad you broke that down, because what I, not knowing the Bible, I just took it as, and I didn't know Jesus was saying this, so I took it as a metaphor for like, if there's someone in your group who's not being good, who's a threat, kick them out to save your whole group. So I thought he was sort of almost threatening Merle, like, if you're bad for us, you're going to have to go. But the way you're breaking it down, I kind of like it better. It's more like trying to, and it makes more sense for something that Herschel would say, that he's coaching Merle, like, hey, all these bad tendencies that you have. I mean, Merle says later, I've done things that I regret,
you know,
pre and post apocalypse, that Herschel would be telling him, you need to change.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually had the same thought. Like, is Herschel telling Merle that he's the eye that needs to be gouged out of the group?
Yeah, that was what I was thinking. But I don't think so. Now that you're talking about it, I think it's more like he's doing more counseling.
Okay. Yeah.
Right?
I think so, yeah. And then Merle, like, maybe subtly communicates understanding, because he finishes the Bible verse, which I just want to break that. Like, what do you make of that?
I loved it, because it instantly just deepened the hell out of, no pun intended, out of Merle's character. Like, he's in Woodbury. And it's interesting, too, that he said Woodbury has a great library, which sort of suggests that he never was into the Bible until now.
Right.
But while he was in Woodbury, I mean, it's a little hard to believe that, because if Lucy was here, she could tell us exactly how many days he maybe was in Woodbury. Would he really have time to have that much facility with the Bible? But whatever, department of suspension disbelief. The point is that he was looking for something, you know, he was searching, he was trying to find meaning in this horrible world or something like that, you know, enough to go and read the Bible and know it well enough to be able to quote it back to Herschel. That just blows my mind. It's like, oh, there's another facet to Merle that I never would have suspected. I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and it makes me picture, like, I picture him in Woodbury studying the Bible. Like, it takes a lot of reading and a lot of study to be able to quote back a verse.
Yeah.
Random just verse happened to pick off one the top of your head.
He knew. Like, yeah, that's the body part one. I know that one.
Right, that one stuck with me.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I kind of like to think that maybe earlier in his life, Merle, he studied the Bible at some point.
Yeah.
Maybe in childhood and adolescence, or
pretty common in the South.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And maybe he lost it, kind of like Herschel said, I lost more than the good book for a while there. And maybe that's another thing they have in common. Merle started studying it too when he got back to Woodbury. Who knows? But yeah, very, very interesting. Totally a different level of depth than we've seen at all.
Did you watch Breaking Bad?
Only the first two or three seasons.
Stay with it. There's this one character called Skinny Pete, who's this just kind of pockmarked drug addict.
Yeah.
And one of a sort of deadbeat friend who ends up becoming this great character. And there's this one point where him and his buddy Badger are in a music store, and Skinny Pete sits down at one of the electric pianos and just starts playing this beautiful classical music. And I just love that part. It's like, oh, wow.
Who is this guy?
You never know about people sometimes, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, so I wanted to mention also in that scene with Herschel, he starts running down the list of, like, this is what the governor is going to do when he gets here. These are the people mm-hmm. he's going to kill. And he says, even the baby. And that, for some reason, took me out. That hit harder than anything. And I know, I trust Merle to know the governor. And just the thought of that was so sickening to me in that moment.
And that he would save Rick for last so he could force him to watch. And I'm like, wow.
That's sick. You know,
back when Andrea asked Merle if the governor was a good guy, and he goes, yeah. And it's like, you knew all that and you said that, but Merle thinks differently, you know, and he's just like, this is maybe the kind of guy you want in your corner, was what he was thinking, or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows in that moment.
Yeah.
But yes, he's then lying. Right, yeah. Like, or he's good enough for me in this moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's the brief interaction between Merle and Michonne after this, where she's exercising and he comes up and tries to apologize. Well, Merle apologizes and says, I was only following orders, basically. I love this. When Michonne said, she pauses and she says, like the Gestapo, sarcastically, and Merle responds so genuinely, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like that. You got it.
Thank you for understanding.
It's so wrong and so funny.
Right.
I thought it was hilarious too. And I think he, even to give him a little credit, even he knows that that's a fucked up answer, but he doesn't care.
Okay. You know?
Yeah. He's like, yeah. But I love that because, you know, he treats people with disrespect most of the time, but with Michonne, it's like, oh, yeah, you good, smart to work out. Don't forget the cardio. And he's like, I think he's terrified of her, right? He's trying to, like, make sure that they're okay because he's afraid she's going to kill him. And she doesn't seem on board. She's got this scowl on her face, but she's also not arguing with anybody that they should kick him out. So I wonder if she's like me, like, you know, maybe we can use this guy. He knows what the governor's about. So she's sort of just vibing. As long as you're helping us, you can live.
Yeah, but I am ready to murder you if need be.
Right. Without, you know, in a split second. And he knows, I mean, the reason he's terrified of her, at least one reason, is because when he tried to kill her in the woods, she was just so badass. And she jumped down from the trees and killed a couple of his guys. Yeah, totally. Yeah. He's lucky to be alive.
Right.
He knows it.
Yeah. Are they, like, setting us up, do you think, for they're trying to warm us up to Merle a little bit in this episode so that we start to
care
and we're sad when he dies?
Yeah, I think this season is about that. I think it's trying to humanize him a little bit.
Yeah.
Whether it works or not, you know.
I'll allow it. Yeah.
I had a point about him, too. I think we covered most of it, but it's just interesting to see him. We haven't seen him as part of the group since season one, episode two, on the roof. And that was the only time we saw him as part of the group. But it was a lot different now. I was thinking, what's changed? Well, Daryl's here, and he's sort of a mitigating factor that can help keep him in line. He's also much stronger of a person than he was then.
Right. You know,
and he's bonded with this group. He respects the group. So he knows that they don't like Merle. So just him being there can help keep Merle in line. Also, as I said before, Merle knows that he's in danger. The governor wants to kill him. And there's just a clear hierarchy in place with Rick. Well, Rick's sort of fumbling, but he's supposed to be the leader and everything. And I think maybe the most important thing is there's no drugs around to amp him up, because I really think that's
so true.
What was the biggest problem on the roof, is he was high and just out of his mind, you know?
Yeah.
So there's more stability, potential for stability now than there was back then, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue that it's in their best interest to, like, I kind of already said this, but to keep him around at least until they deal with the governor and then decide mm-hmm. what to do. Right? Don't you think?
Yeah, or, I agree. As hard as it is for Maggie and Glenn,
yeah,
they have to use some reason and understand that he could be useful.
Mm-hmm. But I totally don't blame them for being the way that they are, given what they went through, though.
No. It's still super raw, the trauma. And,
all right.
They have every right to be pissed.
So I'm going to move on to my biggest point is what's Andrea thinking and what's she trying to do.
Great.
I really just, everything she's saying is she's trying to prevent any more deaths of innocent people, any more fighting. And I believe she does care about the innocent people in Woodbury and in the prison. And she was a civil rights attorney before the zombie apocalypse. So I think she cares about people. Also, as a lawyer, she tries to find solutions other than violence, you know, negotiations. That's what lawyers are all about.
Right.
And it also means compromise a lot of times on both sides. But I also think, as much as she doesn't want to admit it to herself, as Michonne said, she is caught in the governor's spell, at least to some degree, you know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She knows he's not good at this point. Like, when he's telling her, she's like, you went to the prison? And he's like, we went there to negotiate and they attacked. And she says, I'm sick of your lies and I'm not going to watch this town and my friends gun each other down. And then later to Milton, she says, Woodbury is an armed camp with child soldiers, cannon fodder in a war over what? And so she's pretty clear that the situation is not good and that it's the governor's fault.
I might disagree about that point.
Well, go ahead, say more.
No, I just, when she gets to the prison, I got the impression from her that she believed that Rick and the gang are the aggressors.
Oh, so, well, I mean, she got there and she said that he told me you fired first. So yeah, I think maybe she still doesn't quite get the extent of it, but I think she knows that the governor is at least partly at fault because she's so frustrated with him and she sees him.
Yeah.
So, I could see her realizing that the governor's at least partly at fault with all of this and maybe a lot at fault, but not thinking that it would help much to just say, fuck you, man, I'm out of here. That she still feels like she's in a position right now to try to turn a bad situation into something workable for all these innocent people that she wants to save. So she goes to the prison. Rick was really rough with her, which is really interesting to watch how he threw her against the fence.
Get on
the
floor.
The Zed's right there. Ah, yeah, get on the ground. And then says, welcome back. I love that. and then she goes in and says, where's Shane? And Rick shakes his head.
First question.
And at that point, I would stop asking where people are. Don't, like, where's Lori? What about T-Doc? Jimmy?
What do you think?
Patricia? Like, just shut up. Okay, look around. Whoever's here is here.
Like, take a wild don't guess.
Open those old wounds. God. And then it's pretty quickly clear in the prison that no one trusts her, not even Carl. She goes, Carl, and he's just got that stoic,
right, totally blank
look on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of like, you're all up in my business, but you're okay with him, pointing at Merle, which, fair.
Fair point, yeah.
But I don't blame them for being careful because they know, well, it's hard to know for sure what they know. I was trying to think about it. Like, we know Daryl, who might have noticed her in the stands sitting next to the governor when he was being forced to fight his brother to the death. But you'd think it was mostly Michonne that would have told them anything. And she says, what'd you tell them? And Michonne says, nothing. And then later, Andrea says, you've poisoned them. And Michonne says, I just told them the truth. So, you know, Michonne told them everything, probably.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
The details, the sick details that they didn't know. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I guess Andrea knows now. And it has not affected her.
I mean, my guess is Michonne told them Andrea is sleeping with the governor, basically, yeah. Right? I mean, and that I tried to get her to leave and she wouldn't listen to me and she stayed and she's with him.
Yeah.
So
like what,
I don't.
Just what she said to Andrea when they were talking outside the prison. Like,
and I don't blame.
A warm bed.
Yeah, over your friend. And I don't blame them for being untrustworthy of her because she might be casing the joint.
Well, yeah. She even asks at one point, oh, can I see like where you're living?
Right.
Why do you need to see where we're living?
Yeah.
And she
says, why would she?
Right. She says, Rick, I'm not an enemy. But then she goes back to the governor and tells him answers every question that he has for her.
I know. She's like, Rick, I'm not an enemy. How much ammo do you have, by the way? So she's trying to get Rick to negotiate with the governor, and he's like, no, we're going to kill him. And she's like, we can settle this. So I do think that's maybe what she's trying to do. Then she's like, no, or Rick's like, if you can't help us get inside, you're of no use to me. And then Michonne, I'm going to talk about Michonne a little bit more in another point, but
great. She
says Andrea was under the governor's spell from the second she laid eyes on him, and she still is. And Andrea says, no, I'm there because the people need me. And then I'll get back to that. But then Carol, interesting that Carol's the one who comes up with the idea for Andrea to have sex with the governor and then kill him in his sleep. And I was wondering if maybe she fantasized about doing that to Ed at some point or something, you know?
Oh, dang. Probably.
Probably. Yeah.
Yep.
But then this confused me. They just give Andrea, after Rick says, no, if you're not going to help us get in, and, you know, they're not even sure they can trust her. I mean, she does at least tell them, hey, he wants to start a war with you. All the people think that you're, so she gives them some information at the prison. Then they just give her a car and a gun and send her back. And I'm like, what are they didn't agree on anything, you know?
Right. Like, yeah. What was the purpose of
this? What's the plan here?
Yeah.
They said no, and Rick said no for negotiation. Andrea said no for helping fight. So they just send her back. And I'm like, they should not let her go back unless they have some kind of a plan. Cause right now they just know that she's his girlfriend and she knows more about the prison. So,
right.
And I don't think they know what Carol told her to do.
No, I don't think
so
either.
I don't think that anybody else knew that. So that seemed like kind of a plot hole to me to just let her go back.
I thought the same thing. Like there should have been some resolution of some sort. Yeah.
Yeah. Like make use of this somehow, or if you can't, then don't let her go.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even think about them keeping her. That would have been interesting.
Just put her up like they did with Randall. Right. They could kill her. So that's dark. Merle could do it. So back in Woodbury, she talks with the governor, and I think the governor's like, because he told Milton to go ahead and let her go. I guess he did that just feeling confident that she would come back and give him information.
Okay.
Right?
I was kind of wondering what his game was, but I guess in the end it was just to get information, just using her as a pawn.
I guess. Basically. Yeah, he uses everyone as pawns.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and she does, as you said, she says, oh, they're all broken. They're living in horrible conditions. Michonne, Merle, and Rick are there. So that's intel that she gives him. And I'm like, maybe that was just to gain his trust so that she could spend the night with him and kill him. But why tell him the truth then? You know, make up some lies.
Just...
So then I'm like, are you still hoping to work out an agreement? But it seems like at that point, her plan is to kill him. And then they start making out. And I'm thinking the look in her eye looks like she's, you know, not, she's faking it, but I think she's partly into it. She's telling herself she's faking
really
it.
She really is under, right, right. No, yeah. She really is under his spell, and she has some sort of, she loves toxic men. Like she
it happens.
You know, it totally does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. we would expect more from her, but nope.
Nope. And
never
I mean,
out of that.
Yeah. And I think it's more interesting to have characters who do things like this than to have everyone be psychologically healthy.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. That but would make
then
for
it's annoying. it just gives you someone to yell at when you're watching TV. You know,
you're right.
What the fuck, you stupid?
Just stab him.
yeah, because then she can't bring herself to kill him, and so that's like the tragic moment in her story. That moment right there. We just saw the moment
right. where that's it's where like, everything. Wah, wah. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. I mean, maybe there is part of her that's like, maybe we can still negotiate, but like I said, I mean, no, this is what I was going to say before, that she knows at this point, because Michonne told her, that the governor sent people to kill Michonne after they let her go.
That her face after that was like, oh shit.
Yeah. Ooh. That he kidnapped Glenn and Maggie, that he forced Daryl and Merle to fight to the death, that he went to the prison and attacked and then lied to her about it. Mm-hmm. That he's arming and training his people down to the 13-year-olds to go to the prison and attack, and lying to his people about what happened and why, you know, to get them to do it. She should know, based on all that, that there's no reasoning that's going to happen here with this guy.
Right.
You know, at this point, if she's still thinking, I'm in a position where I can work things out, so I don't want to kill him, she should know better than that. So that's why
that was your shot, girl.
I do think that it's wrapped up in her just being caught up in his spell too.
Yeah. Like she's convincing herself that she can save everybody, because really the bottom line is she doesn't want to kill her lover.
Yeah. Yep.
There must be some good in him if I feel this way about him.
Yeah. And it's hard to, when emotion is involved, it often trumps logic, you know?
Absolutely. Simple as that. True. Yeah. Yes.
So that's all I had for that one. Anything else about her and them? I mean, I do want to talk about her with Michonne, but I have that one as separate, so we can talk about something else or whatever.
Okay. Should I do my case study in adolescence about Carl?
Yeah.
I'll try to make it quick. Okay.
No, you don't have to make it quick.
Okay, so moving over to Woodbury, the first scene that we see there, the governor and Milton are sort of taking a head count of their soldiers. Mm-hmm. And you briefly mentioned, you know, the governor says, well, what about 13 and older? And Milton says, you mean boys and girls? And he says, adolescence, it's a 20th century invention.
It's a great line.
Such a good line. And fact check, true.
Yeah, right.
Did a little bit of a
working
deep dive.
In factories, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yep. Yeah. Like the concept of the developmental stage of adolescence as we know it was introduced in 1904. Here's my deep dive. By the very first president of the American Psychological Association, G. Stanley Hall. And like you said, child labor laws. So child labor laws, universal education, everybody starts going to public school. Adolescents had newfound time in their teenage years when the responsibilities of adulthood weren't forced on them as quickly as they were in the past. They're not going to the factories at 13 years old or whatever. So G. Stanley Hall writes a book or an essay about adolescence. And he calls it a period of inevitable turmoil that takes place during the transition from childhood to adulthood. He believed that society needed to burn out the vestiges of evil in their nature, and that adolescence was a time of overcoming one's beast-like impulses, as one was engulfed
in a period. All true, yes.
Right? Yeah, you're in it.
I got a couple, yeah.
Yeah. He called the period a period of storm and stress, the storm being the decreased level of self-control and the stress being an increased level of sensitivity or emotionality. And he identified three key aspects of the phase: mood disruptions, conflict with parents, and risky behavior. So as I'm thinking about Carl, as I'm reading through all of this, that right there, mood disruptions, conflict with parents, risky behavior, is totally Carl in season two. Mm-hmm. When everybody was super annoyed with him. So moving on to a little more education. In the 1950s and 60s, Eric Erickson, who was a psychoanalyst, he focused on eight different psychosocial stages of development. and really solidified as adolescence as a stage of development. I'm a therapist, by the way, so this is my jam, which is why I totally indulged in this sort of section. So adolescence is the fifth stage of development from age 12 to 18. And every stage of development is characterized by a, quote, psychosocial crisis that could positively or negatively affect personality development. So in each stage of development, Erik Erikson sort of defines a big life question that needs to be answered and resolved positively. And if it's not, then you're screwed as you grow up, as you go through life, basically. So a person in adolescence is supposed to have the freedom to explore their interests, their values, their goals, and create sort of a well-rounded identity, a strong sense of self, as we all did, I'm sure, at least most of us, just kind of going to high school, exploring stuff with friends, right? Mm-hmm. Like maybe getting a job, maybe not. Sports, clubs, social relationships are super important. Again, like thinking about Carl here, feeling accepted, fitting in with your peers. These are critical for self-esteem, experiencing diversity of thought and experiences as a way to help you form your identity and your values. So like being able to disagree with someone and still respect them. And the importance of conflict resolution as an important part of developing social skills as well. And one quote that I saw that I liked related to Carl is, adolescence is the stage between the morality learned in childhood and the ethics developed as an adult. And so if I'm relating all of this back to Carl as a 13-year-old that we're seeing in this episode and the governor's knowledge, basically, that adolescence is a 20th century invention, we see Carl in this episode specifically, he tells his father he should stop being the leader, which is a very, I mean, that's a mature thing to do for him to recognize that and then, you know, feel comfortable enough with his dad to let him know.
You know what's interesting about that, just really quickly, that I just thought of is,
please.
Like, I think Carl, I think everything that we've seen from Carl is him sort of taking after his dad, that he wants to be a protector like his father. And I think that's Rick's main character element until now, where it's gotten into a dark. His main thing is being a protector, but then when he fails at that, then he becomes reactive about it and not as effective, you know, like who was it? Somebody in this episode, Andrea told Carol that Rick's become cold and unsteady. And I'm like, yeah, that's totally true. And it gets worse. It's not the whole encompassing thing that encompasses Rick. But I think over time, because he becomes less compassionate towards strangers. I guess I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I got a little off track there. But Carl, I think, is trying to emulate his dad by being a protector. And then what's ironic here is that Carl realizes to be the best protector in this moment, I have to tell my dad to stop. Stop doing it.
Oh, I love that perspective. It's
kind of interesting. But that you don't agree, huh? You don't agree that Rick is cold and unsteady?
Well, I agree that he's cold and unsteady. I just, like Carol, so Carol literally gets done telling Lori why he had to kill Shane and how Lori died. And then Andrea
that's what she
says,
comes up with.
He's become cold, unsteady. Yeah. She goes, he has his reasons, but ones I just fucking told you.
Yeah, that's a good point. I agree. But I think she has a point too, though. I mean, she's just stewing on being treated badly by him, I think. Listening to Carol, seems like.
Right, like, what if he... If he wasn't cold, how would he be dealing with the governor? Like, how would these 8 to 10 people be defending themselves.
Right. I mean, so looking at like the way Andrea wants to try to negotiate, Rick is like, let's just kill him. And I think probably based on everything we know that Rick is probably right. You know, that's a hard thing for me to say. The right thing to do is kill someone. But I think maybe it is. But I think that it's kind of just by coincidence that he's right, because at this point, or especially as time goes on, Rick's first instinct is to kill anything that seems like a threat without much thought, you know? And so what about when the time comes when he's not right to just kill, but that's just his reaction because of this trauma that he's gone through about failing to protect people from threats, you know? So maybe Andrea sort of senses a bit of that, you know? I mean, Tyrese certainly saw that.
Yeah.
Rick.
I don't know. I feel like you might be giving Andrea too much credit in this moment.
I can agree with that. Yeah. So I'm sorry. I kind of interrupted you.
No, that's okay. I'm
good. I like this whole psychoanalysis of Carl.
Oh, good. So let's think about Carl as technically an adolescent in the apocalyptic world, and who he shows himself to be in this episode. So he talks to his father. He's on watch with Maggie. He's the one who spots Andrea. So like, he doesn't have a different role just because he's younger. He's totally integrated. His peers are basically all adults. Even Beth at this point is 17. Like, she's not really a peer.
Yeah. Closest like, thing, which exactly. is saying something, because they're not really.
Yeah. in the real world, they would not be peers. But
yeah,
you know, apocalypse. Here we go. So he carries that M4, I think, that big rifle with him, which is such a visual. Little Carl carrying around the big rifle and the flak jacket and all that. And then at the end, of course, Rick deciding that he's gonna take him on a run because he's ready,
right?
And kind of thinking about what the adolescents at Woodbury are like, and Noah the asthmatic, and we didn't really see any other adolescence, but
you get the feel that there's kids playing around and stuff,
right? They're just having fun. There's a school, like all of the normal life stuff. So they've been able to indulge in this normalcy of exploring their identity and, you know, becoming friends with people and not exploring their values in the same way that Carl has been forced to, and not having the same diversity of experiences that Carl has had, except that also Carl's sort of on the opposite side of the spectrum, where maybe he doesn't have diversity of experiences because all his experiences in adolescence so far are fighting to the death and survival. Yeah. And, you know, he doesn't have normal peer-to-peer socialization and.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, if you're talking about like the Maslow's hierarchy of needs that I bring up a lot, he's still stuck in the bottom couple levels.
Yeah, survival. Yeah, exactly.
Turns out pretty good given all that.
I know. And yeah, so like that's, I started thinking about Carl in future upcoming episodes and then future seasons. Soon we're going to see him shoot that kid in the woods and, you know, he's.
It makes more sense when you think about it through this lens. Yeah.
Right. Like I'm going to agree with the governor and I feel a little sick for that, but it's the apocalypse and there's no time for the adolescence that Paul and Erickson identified and developed as a stage of development. It's, you know, your place. It's with us. You belong here. You are valuable. You're important. We need you. Your role is just like everybody else to protect the group. And part of me thinks it's a little simpler that way. So please give me your perspective.
Well, I think So the governor I think of in two stages. You know, stage one is I have this zombie daughter that I'm trying to bring back from the dead and create this world where she can do all the kind of things that you're saying a kid, a healthy kid should and can do in today's society. So that's what Woodbury was all about, recreating that kind of world. And only around the edges do you need the hard, tough people. It's kind of like our country, you know, the army does that for the military so that we get to have these varied and artful lives and whatever else. And I'm thankful for that. Thank you, anyone who's served for us to be able to have this freedom, you and everyone else. Yeah. I forgot. I knew you did. I appreciate it very much. So I think that's the best way to do it, of course. I'm going to say that.
That's ideal. Sure.
Yeah. But, and I think if you can't, that's the ideal. Yeah. Like you said, like you just said, it's the ideal. And that's what the Commonwealth is all about. And all the communities, you know, they want, they probably, I mean, I think depending on the security level of the community, basically, that's how much you get to let kids be kids. So I think you think about Israel. I don't know a whole lot about Israel, but I know everyone has to go into the military, you know, or there's other countries like that too, not to just pick out one that's a hot button thing to even talk about right now. But, you know, when you have less security, then you need more people involved in it. So I think ideally it's good to strive for a society where you could let the kids not have to grow up too quickly, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But is that
I think that's
doable
a fair point.
Right now? I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah.
I think, well, I mentioned the governor in two stages. Like he kind of had that as far as we saw in stage one. But as soon as Penny was killed by Michonne, well, zombie Penny, she was already dead. But anyway, in his mind, his daughter was killed. And then his whole, like he uses everyone as pawns, as we said before. So before, the way they were being used as pawns is to create this idyllic American city. But now the way they're being used as pawns is as soldiers. So that's why they don't have to, they seem to have the capability to keep Woodbury secure and let kids be kids, but the governor doesn't care about people. He just wants revenge now. So they're all soldiers, they're pawns.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way, how the adolescents also were pawn, like in what way were they pawns for the governor?
He's a user.
He is a user.
I mean, I like that, because I thought about that too. Like he was talking about, you know, adolescence is a 20th century invention. And then I think it was on purpose by the writers in the same episode. Do you have Rick bringing Carl out to go on a run?
Right. Yeah. You know? Showing the actual child soldier.
Yeah. But they're thinking about it that way on both sides.
Right. I think it'll be fun to see how Carl transitions over the next few seasons. And
yeah.
You know, once he gets to Alexandria and tries to fit in with some peers and
I was just thinking that. Like, I can't remember, but now I can't wait to get to that part again and experience it again.
Yeah.
Because I imagine they'd be like, why is this kid so dark?
Yeah, I remember him being super awkward.
Yeah. Can't wait. Yeah. But also, I think the kids at first come from Woodbury over to the prison next season.
Oh, right? That's right.
So there's some interaction
there.
Yeah,
the kid plays with Legos. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see that too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, can't wait. Oh, my gosh.
But let's see. Michonne's take on Andrea. So Michonne and Andrea take a little walk and talk, and Michonne's pissed that Andrea sided with the governor, of course. And Andrea says, I didn't choose him over you. I wanted a life. And I can totally get that. As I've said, in zombie apocalypse, I think your goal is to find a place like Woodbury or Alexandria or Hilltop. You know, that's the highest goal for most people, not to go fight for your life with your new cool friend amongst the zombies. No,
survival isn't the goal. Like near survival.
You want a place like Woodbury. That's what you want. And so, and Michonne says Andrea was under the governor's spell, and she says, no, I'm there because the people need me. Well, that's where Michonne turns out to be right. I think it's both. I think Andrea does want to help the people, but what supersedes that is her love of toxic Ben, as you said.
Yeah. In that moment, I just wanted her to own up to it.
Yeah.
It would have been so much better if she was like, you know what? you're right. But also,
yeah.
And also, these people need me.
Right. But then it would have, like, the things we want to happen a lot of times just kill the drama.
Totally.
You know what I mean? But yes.
Right.
I felt critical of Michonne in this conversation a bit. She's so harsh. Like, Andrea said, I'm there because these people need me. And she goes, and what about these people? Meaning Rick and the people at the prison. Mm-hmm. Andrea says, I'm trying to save them too. Michonne says, I didn't realize the Messiah complex was contagious. I'm like, Michonne doesn't know. Michonne knows the people at the prison maybe a little bit better than the people at Woodbury, but they're all, she doesn't know them that much more. And they're all in danger and they're innocent and it's a worthy cause. And I don't think Andrea should be mocked for trying to help people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. True.
And she's in a unique position to maybe be able to do something about it. Probably not, but better position than most people. So I don't like Michonne's dismissiveness there. Then when she said, you chose a warm bed over a friend, that always makes me think of my friend Chad, who we lived in these apartments right across the way from each other that were like mirror images of each other. And we would just hang out at each other's places all the time. His was a total mess. Mine was awesome. But anyway, that's beside the point. And so we would just like hang out and have a great time. And then he met his girlfriend, who became his wife pretty quickly after that. And I almost never saw him. And I felt pretty resentful about it. But over time, I realized this is what happens. And, you know, it could have been a little better than that. But and we do hang out every once in a while now. But it's just what happens. You know, you have a period in your life where you have a lot of friends, and then sometimes you get married and then you have a new life and you don't get to spend as much time in your old life anymore. It just feels like that's a parallel, except that she has this thing for toxic men. So,
yeah. So you're saying like Michonne theoretically should be more understanding of Andrea wanting a warm bed and.
Yeah. And wanting to meet someone.
A life. Yeah.
Yeah. And have a life. And I mean, I can see Michonne saying, look, you picked the wrong guy, but not saying you should have been loyal to me. It sounds like she's feeling like you should have been loyal to me over any guy because I'm your friend. And I'm like, that's not how life works.
She was really petty in this scene.
Like, yeah.
So dismissive, so petty. It was kind of amusing, but yeah.
I mean, Michonne tells her the governor sent Merle to kill her and would have sent them to kill both of them. That's good. Mm-hmm. Like, Michonne needed to say more concrete things like that, solid evidence of what the governor is. But then she says, I went back to Woodbury to expose the governor for what he is, and I knew it would hurt you. And I'm like, well, I think you went back to kill the governor. I don't know if you were doing anything necessarily to expose him. And you ended up killing his zombie daughter, which is the one thing that would put him on the warpath to put everyone in danger. And so I'm like, you kind of solve everything with violence. So that's why I'm feeling a little bit critical of Michonne here. Like, she just seems like she thinks I did everything right and I'm so right and you're so wrong, rather than, hey, let's work this out, friend. You know?
Yeah. That's, I'm glad you're bringing this up, because I definitely think of Michonne through rose-colored glasses. And
I feel like later Michonne wouldn't be quite like this. Like,
yeah, she would it was be almost a little, childish. It
yeah,
was very
she would be a little bit more adolescent. Like understanding of Andrea wanting to try to help innocent people, I feel like.
Yes.
No,
I don't know. Well, in this moment, I feel like being more understanding of Andrea trying to help innocent people would make sense. Like, she's totally dismissing. You're right. She's totally dismissing the fact that Andrea is actually just trying to help, because it's totally overshadowed by, you betrayed me.
Yeah. And you're caught up in this guy who's clearly an asshole, which is true.
Right.
Yeah. It's all true. Like, I'm not saying Michonne is totally wrong. I'm not saying that. And I know also that I just want to acknowledge that probably most people listening to me are like, whatever, Jason, Michonne's the best. Andrea sucks.
dare you criticize her?
I get that. I'm just trying to find the nuance here.
I agree that she grows. The Michonne that we're seeing now and that we've seen like thus far, totally a different character than the Michonne of later years. And I think it's probably just a matter of Denai Guerrero like figuring out who the character was, the writers figuring out who the character was. But
and some of it could be just emotional growth for the character. But I agree. Yeah. She seems like they've found a little bit of a different character later on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In this scene, it seemed like she was purposely saying the things that she knew would hurt her the most, even if they weren't totally true.
Yeah. Which sometimes you see friends do that for sure.
Yeah.
Like she's trying to hurt her.
High school girlfriends. For sure.
Sounds like you speak from experience.
Yeah. Quite possibly.
Which side were you on? No, we won't get into it.
That's my trauma. Don't go there.
So, anything more on them too, or do you have any other points?
I think that covers it for Michonne and Andrea. Should we just touch on Tyrese and Sasha?
Yeah, I really didn't have much to say about them.
Yeah.
What about you?
I just love that Tyrese makes a hell of an entrance every time. he came in, and once again, I was just like, yes! Oh my gosh! Yeah. There he is!
Hero.
And...
And then I love when he said to the governor that, you know, all the people seem decent over there except for the leader. Like, he's just wanting to point that out, you know, and nobody cares, but it was
right.
Good of him.
Besides the point. Yeah, and just the way the governor looked at Sasha in that scene when he said, gazes at her meaningfully for a second with his one eye and says, you can't be too careful these days. And it just felt like him doing the thing he always does with a new attractive woman, which is trying to warm up to her a little bit.
Turn on the charm.
Yes, I felt it in that moment.
Interesting. That's funny. And she, I'd have to go watch it again, but I don't feel like she's suspicious of him, but I don't think she's particularly like drawn in either.
No, she's
just sort
neutral.
Of like kind of concerned about the whole situation, you know?
Yeah. He was just drooling when they said they'd been inside the prison too. Just immediately.
Yeah. What?
Turned on almost. Give me the details now.
Tell me all the dirt.
Right. But yeah, that's pretty much it about them.
I don't have much. I like seeing Sasha on the screen. She's one of my favorite characters.
Me too.
I think in the show, she's so great. Yeah. So let's see. Now Rick, let's talk about Rick a little bit. So,
okay.
I'm like, okay, what is his plan? Like, I'm just trying to, so Herschel's like, get with it, Rick. And then Carl tells him to step down as a leader. And then I'm just thinking, okay, so the governor is working out all his psychodrama. If only he had said, you know what? I lost my daughter. I was trying to bring her back. It didn't work. You know, it just sort of been honest about instead of saying these people are killers and we need to go kill them. And he wants revenge. It's just like he's lying to himself and everybody else about what's at the core of why. And I just think that happens with leaders, like their trauma informs their decisions and then they get everybody else wrapped up into it often by lying to them. I think Putin's probably had a really bad childhood or something, you know.
Yeah.
and I think just mentioning that in the context of Rick, because I think he's working out his own psychodrama too. I already kind of mentioned this, but he's traumatized at having failed to protect the people that he cares about. So now he's focused on killing threats without a lot of thought, but maybe in this situation, it's the right thing to do. I guess I already said that. What is he trying to do though? At first he's fortifying the prison. He's telling them to fix the fence, move the bus in place, kill some walkers. And then later, after Andrea leaves, Rick, Herschel, and Daryl are talking, and Herschel says she's persuasive, but he's armed to the teeth and bent on destruction. So Herschel seems to think that Andrea will try to persuade the governor not to attack, and maybe that's one reason why they went ahead and sent her back in the car, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Little thin, though. But then Daryl says, so what do you want to do? And Rick says, we match it. I'm going on a run. Match it, I guess, means armed. When Herschel said he's armed to the teeth and bent on destruction, I think that's what he's saying. He wants to match. He's going out
right,
on a run,
need
I guess.
Right, more firepower.
Yeah, yeah, find ammo and prepare for war and bring Carl with him on the run and everything. So I guess that's just pretty simple, you know, what his plan is just get armed up and get ready for war.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get into notes. You go first.
The final scene and Tom Waits' Hold On is just the perfect song. I freaking love that. I was so excited to see that Beth was singing. I totally forgot that the episode ends with her singing. Such a treat. I love Emily Kinney's voice.
Yeah, and I think there's a version of that on Apple Music of her singing it, and I will listen to it every once in a while and just feel nostalgic for when this was all going on and there was conventions and everything.
Oh, yeah. So nice. I'm like always in the top 1% of Emily Kinney's listeners on Spotify.
Oh, really?
It's ridiculous. Yeah. Yes.
She's great.
It's so stupid. I love her voice.
Yeah. And the songs she sings are emotional.
Very emotional, very real, very relatable. Just
and they're catchy. They're
good. Super catchy. Yeah. Sometimes dark, sometimes poppy and light. Yeah. It's just, she's great. And just the lyrics of the song being about a woman who gets herself in a jam, like leaves her hometown looking for bigger and better things and wants her man to come along, but he refuses. And she leaves anyway. And then she finds herself in a jam alone in the cold, thinking of her hometown. Made me think of Andrea. And
that's Andrea. Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah. I thought it was really funny too. They cut.
Beth is like, this one goes out to you, Andrea.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, they cut to her in the governor's bedroom naked right after the lyric. What is it? If you share my bed, you share my name. Mm. Yeah.
And it was interesting. You don't often see a woman's naked butt on a TV show.
Right.
And I thought the reason why they did that is just to really emphasize the intimacy of the moment that she's in this very intimate, vulnerable relationship with him. And that ended up overpowering her common sense.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. That's a powerful image.
Andrea's butt. I'll podcast art.
Banging body. If that was really her, great job.
Yeah. I'm glad you said it.
Okay. not to objectify.
But yeah. What else? Any other notes?
Just the walkers in this episode. It was directed by Greg Nicotero, and I feel like there were a few parts where I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. The walkers were.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh, yeah. When she's making her pet to take to the jail and
giving him the Michonne treatment.
Yeah, plus the governor's eye. Ugh.
When he looks at his eye, I just think he's thinking, I want to kill Michonne. She did this.
Definitely.
It seemed like that Zed was feeling pain the way that the zombie actor acted when she chopped his arms off. He'd be like, chop, chop. It was a very gruesome scene. Yeah, don't stop. I'm sorry. But then Sasha and Tyrese show up, and Milton says it's a diversionary tactic, keeps the other walkers away. And Sasha points at the two zombies that had just attacked them and says, didn't work so well with those two. And I'm like, I think it's so stupid. This whole thing would ever work. Why?
Yeah. It seemed even like less beneficial with her than it was with
Michonne. But one of the listeners wrote in a little while ago and said something about, because I thought it was kind of silly that this would actually work for Michonne, but he said it had something to do with like, she seems like the alpha and because she has them under control or something like that. And so they respect that. Hmm. And I don't know if there's anything to that, but if so, it would apply here because when the other zombies were attacking, Andrea didn't quite have control over this one yet.
True.
She didn't have control over it until they'd killed all of them. So,
yeah. Did you notice the walker that came up behind her in the prison yard? It was like, Where she like really she turns around and like swipes her ass.
Yeah,
at
oh
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was like, and I just like had a flashback to like one of the most like one of those awful haunted houses where they're allowed to touch you and they just come up behind you.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And you wished you had
super
an axe.
Creepy. Yeah. Yes. Don't ever bring me a
rubber axe. Mm-hmm. Bonk. Nerf bat. Okay. I have a few. So okay. The Walking Dead wiki says, quote, during his Q&A panel at Walker Stalker Con Chicago 2014, Greg Nicotero revealed an alternate ending for Andrea's scene at the end. He said he was so devoted to her character that he was trying to pitch an alternative ending which shows Andrea slashing something off screen and it would be revealed in the next episode that she indeed slit the governor's throat.
What?
And I was like, I think I moderated that panel. I looked it up. I did.
No way. Oh my God. That's
really
so cool.
I didn't really remember him saying that. But then when I read it, I have some vague memory of it. I'd forgotten.
This rings a bell.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
Sounds familiar.
Told me that once. Oh, it was him. But anyway, that's what he was trying to do. He really stuck up for her. They were friends. Greg Nicotero and Laurie Holden. I remember he was in her corner.
Oh, okay.
The governor puts this asthmatic kid Noah in training to be a soldier for him, and I saw that Karen was the one. She said he's only 14 and he has asthma, and I wondered if they had intended for her to be his mother. But
I was wondering too. Yeah,
we don't see him again, and we do see her, so I don't know. I don't know what's up with that. Maybe she just
maybe
knew
he's
him.
An orphan, and she took him under her wing.
Yeah. Carol tells Daryl she's glad he came back. That was a cute, sweet scene.
Oh, that scene was super cute. Yeah. Don't let your brother bring you down.
Yeah, yeah.
Come so far.
And he's like, all right, what fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks. You're right.
And then they like giggle together.
Yeah. So cute. Okay. But she says, I'm glad you came back. And to what? All this? She goes, this is our home. And he says, this is a tomb. And she goes, that's what T-Dog called it. Thought he was right until you found me, which was so sweet. And it just makes me think of her sitting there in the dark thinking she was going to die and then being saved by this guy with an angel wing vest.
Right. Her like, her guardian angel.
Yep. Couple more. Mm-hmm. Milton rats out Andrea after, she asked him to keep it a secret. And I was like, do I blame him for this? And my first thoughts were like, well, he's probably afraid and the governor's kept him safe and given him purpose. But I'm like, nah, that was a dick thing to do because you know what the governor's like and you're a spineless twerp.
He is a spineless twerp. Oh my gosh. Everybody's saying they have a soft spot for Milton and I kind of get it, but I'm also.
Yeah, I do, but I don't like that he did that. I think that
after 0.2 seconds. And then the governor says, good job, Milton. And I said, there's your red flag, Milton. If the governor is telling you that you did a good job, you're on the wrong team.
I was glad that Andrea got to be back with the group before her end, because I don't think she does again. Mm-hmm. And she was especially glad to see Carol. They hug. You're thinking of her and saying,
yes. Well, I'm thinking of that whole episode leading up to it. Yeah.
The, like he's stalking
the chase.
Her.
Yeah.
But Carol and Andrea hug and they were friends, before Rick even came along. It reminds me of season one.
Oh, true. Yeah. That was a sweet scene. The hug.
And she says, Carol tells Andrea what happened with Rick and Shane. And Carol says, Shane tried to kill Rick. And Andrea says, Shane loved Rick. And Carol says, Shane loved Lori.
I loved that. I loved that. Yeah, the way she said that. Mm-hmm. Shane loved Lori.
I guess that's all I had.
I like that she got to tell Andrea why she was left behind, too. We thought you died after you saved me. That felt like some nice closure.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that had been weighing on Carol's mind a little bit. And
probably
on Andrea's, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to get a little closure around things like that. Closure that Rick and Lori will never have.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. Only on The Walking Dead would two guys connect over having chopped off their own limbs.
That's a good one.
Rick did, but still.
Only on The Walking Dead do you need to curb stomp a zombie just to visit some old friends.
I can't think of any other show where that's true. You win. All right, we're back. It's time for Listener Moans, Groans, and Grunts.
Tej Mateel says, I loved watching Andrea in the prison. The mix of comfort with each other plus the awkward distrust and hostility was fascinating to see on screen.
Yeah, that is a good point. It's like, here's my friend. I kind of missed you, but you may be the enemy.
Right. And in fact, kind of are. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of are. Yeah.
Definitely an odd dynamic.
Michael Anglia says, I'm trying to get caught up with you all so I can leave feedback. I just finished episode 2 of season 3. I'm really enjoying the rewatch episodes. Awesome. Thanks for reigniting my love for The Walking Dead. Well, I'd love to hear that. And yeah, I hope you get caught up. That'd be great.
Michelle Jones says, I like these episodes. Season 3 is where I felt they were hitting their stride. I think the hardest thing to watch in this episode was Andrea breaking the teeth out of that walker. Yes, agreed. I had to shield my eyes. That's me saying that. Michelle goes on. I also wonder what would have happened if Andrea had killed the governor in his sleep. We need a what-if series with this show. What if they changed this decision instead? And how would the show look now? Sorry, those types of storylines intrigue me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, no need to apologize. That would be cool.
Oh, that's what this whole Walking Dead Destinies game is supposed to be.
About that.
That Nathan Eshelman played through, but it was not done well apparently, but maybe it's still interesting. And I know Nathan played through it. So Nathan, if you're hearing this and you feel like it, let us know if there's a, where you can see what happens if the, if Andrea actually kills the governor, that'd be cool. Gloria Hernan, Gloria is back, yay, says, well, the governor always rubbed me the wrong way. I never liked him, and watching this episode, knowing what's ahead, I hate him even more. Can't blame you. I truly wish Andrea had taken care of Philip when she had the chance in bed. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Talk about a totally different story we could have enjoyed. Loved hearing Beth sing again. She's very talented. And Herschel telling Rick to get his shit together, to say the least. So great to see Tyrese and Sasha again. Love them. Carl telling his dad he deserves a rest out of the mouth of babes. Amen. Missed you guys. Bye. I think that's becoming a thing. People are now saying bye a lot.
I know it.
I like it. Okay. We have a call from Steve Brown. Let's see if they said I ain't Judas in this episode or not.
Okay.
Hello, the cast of us. This is Steve, and this is going to be for The Walking Dead. I ain't a Judas. Sounds like something that Merle would say. Oh, Herschel. Harsh to Rick, but truthful. Truly don't remember how they get out of this situation here, but I'm sure it will come to me. Or it's going to play out in the episode. Please, there's no way Andrea is going to believe this, that her people turn bloodthirsty all of a sudden. What you need to do is find one person who will tell her the truth about what happened at the prison. I'm sure there's got to be somebody on the governor's crew who would crack. Oh, so Merle knows his Bible. That's interesting. Ew, that eye looks ugly, governor, but ew. Oh, okay, so Milton's helping her is going to help her make pets like Michonne had. Oh, breaking that Zed's teeth out. Oh! Okay, so I forgot about Tyrese and Sasha going.
Wait, do you think they should not have shown it? So
no, I'm so glad they showed it. It was like awesomely horrific. It was so gruesome and disgusting. Yeah.
It's not like, I think they probably shouldn't have shown Glenn's death in such graphic detail, but we don't care about the zombie. So
right. Yeah, totally different.
Yeah.
That going to Woodbury. I forgot about that. And here, Andrea, she's made it to the prison at least. Okay, so now Andrea is finding out the truth, but I know she goes back to Woodbury for some reason, right? Oh, you just told them that you were at the prison. Ben, right? Is that your name? All right. And Tyrese and Sasha, this group. Uh-oh. Oh, so now we see how Sasha and Tyrese get back. I forgot that they sided with the governor for a little while. And I guess Andrea's going to leave and go back to Woodbury. Oh, and Carol's going to try to convince Andrea to assassinate the governor. I forgot about this. Okay, governor, how are you going to spin it this time? Because now she knows the truth. Oh, and of course, in the midst of all the horribleness, we have the sweet Emily Kinney singing Tom Waits, right? Oh, and the respect between Rick and Daryl right there. He's telling him, your brother's back, but if he causes trouble, you're going to have to take care of him. And Daryl's, I got him. Mm-hmm. Oh, Naked Lori, is she going to try? Lori, Naked Andrea, is she going to try to kill the governor? Nope, apparently not. Well, on to next week.
Nope. That's good.
Brad Holt says, another solid season 3 episode. It's easy to see now why this was the season where the show really took off in popularity. I'd like to also comment on the Maggie Glenn situation. I think people are reading too much into the dynamic. I've always seen it as two people who were traumatized, both physically and emotionally, and then processed the trauma very differently. Glenn externalized his, while Maggie internalized hers. This disparity confused them both and kept them from communicating effectively and led to their temporary estrangement. I don't think possessiveness or blame or the patriarchy had anything to do with it. Hopefully I won't get roasted for this, LOL. Just to interject a little, I like this take with the exception that Glenn externalized it and then projected it onto Maggie in some ways. So that's where I...
Yeah.
Beef with it, but.
Yeah, because he's not being nice to her, I don't think. Right. So it's not like he's, well, he's pretty much mad at everybody, though, but so maybe, but still.
But if he was, he could be mad at everybody except her. That would be great.
Yeah, right, right.
Okay, Brad goes on. With that being said, the shocking thing for me this time was that Herschel wasn't out for the governor's head himself. Pardon the foreshadowing. Cool. Maggie is his daughter, for goodness sake. I have a 20-year-old daughter myself and tell all her boyfriends that if they ever lay a hand on her in anger, that I will end them and take my chances with a jury.
That's first date conversation, right?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay. He says, I'm 61. I wouldn't be in prison that long anyway. Oh, gosh. But seriously, he didn't seem to just shrug it off. Or he did seem to just shrug it off. I would have liked to have seen a scene where he brought the two of them together and helped them communicate. Just my two cents.
Yeah, I think you're right. It would be good to see Herschel expressing some anger towards the governor messing with his daughter. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think I was also surprised that he didn't do more, but I guess they're adults and they got to figure it out themselves.
Why?
In terms of. In terms of Herschel, in terms of like helping them reconcile with each other, but they were working out their own thing separately.
Yeah. So. I mean, he went to Maggie and tried to, did he talk to Glenn too?
I think he went to them separately.
Yeah, he did separately. Yeah. He tried. He did. Mm-hmm. He told Glenn he was like a son to him and everything.
Right.
Rinaldi Calixt, who I haven't heard from in a long time, says, deep exhale. He sent this in, and I was supposed to read it last week and somehow fell through the cracks, so I'm reading it now. But it says, okay. Deep exhale. I'm revealing the truth behind my absence in the feedback section as well as the Facebook Messenger chat open to Patreon supporters of this Walking Dead rewatch. Another deep exhale. At the Zedhead meetup of 2023 in the great city of Boston, which is a humble and unbiased opinion that has nothing to do with me being from that city, there was a costume party that featured a few Zedheads as Walking Dead characters. I was dressed up as Tyrese and Jason was dressed up as Rick. This is all true so far. I know Jason can be so engrossed as the character Rick Grimes when he's in costume that he can go overboard. I predicted that he would reenact the scene in this week's episode where Rick shouts unintelligibly at Tyrese and his group and tells them to get out. But after rewatching season 3, episode 9, The Suicide King, I realized I cannot run anymore, that I needed to get this off my chest so I can be free to write feedback and participate in the Facebook chat. Okay, obviously I'm joking here, but I mean, I didn't do that, but it was only because I didn't think of it. Otherwise, I probably would have.
Totally would have.
Yeah. I just wanted to write in and say thanks for doing this rewatch. I'm excited to participate in the discussion surrounding the rewatch at some point in the fall once I've fully settled into my move into a new apartment and my new job. Keep up the awesome discussions on this podcast and keep being the fun people that you are. No hard feelings, LOL, and please don't get bit, Rinaldi. That's so funny, Rinaldi. Thanks. That was a fun time. A bunch of us hung out at this Airbnb near Boston and had a
fun
blast, karaoke and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, awesome. Billy Thompson says, hello, hello. I'll answer your question from last week first, Jason. I have been listening to the podcast for a good while, maybe 5 to 6 years, but definitely not from the start. I often go back and listen to a lot of the older pods, hence the zombie kill of the week. Before I got a new job, when I could just listen for hours whilst working, my plan was to be the top listener of the cast of us on when the Spotify statistics get revealed at the end of the year. Hopefully I can still, fitting in the pod whenever possible. Also, I think I got to 2 Don't Get Bits, lucky me, Billy Thompson and Bill Thompson.
That's how you sneak in there, just change your name.
Yeah, right. I've called in a couple times. Now I'm thinking of all the names. Mr. Bill Thompson. Mr. Billy. Okay. I've called in a couple times and said Bill from England, but find it easier to get my thoughts across by commenting on here whilst watching the episode. Anyway, enough about me. Opening with a bang, Herschel screaming at Rick and then Carl talking to him. I think these were conversations Rick needed to have to help him pull himself out. But when Herschel says the word clear, it gets me all excited for next episode. Yeah, same. The way Merle talks about the governor in this episode, I think it might be a bit scared of him. I'm not saying he would back down. I'm not sure he would to anyone, even Negan, if that ever happened. That, or he says these things to scare the others into leaving to potentially save his brother. I'm surprised the governor didn't think Tyrese and company were spies sent by Rick.
Yeah,
that's what I'd be thinking if I was him. Or vice versa when they got to the prison. I guess. Just seems too coincidental. Love the ending to this episode with the gang in the prison discussing what to do next. Rick is back, baby. I'm not sure why Andrea didn't kill the governor. The Andrea from seasons 1 and 2 would have. Maybe if she had more of Shane's influence. Well.
Because she loves him, that's why.
Because she was all for doing whatever needed to be done. Letting Beth try to kill herself, willing to let Rick kill Randall initially. Maybe she thought of Dale in that moment. And that's why she wanted to see if there was a way to save everyone. Anyway, sorry it's so long this week. Thanks, guys. Bye.
So funny. Yeah, I think it's because of that whole codependent being caught up in his spell thing.
Yeah.
I think. Thanks, Billy/Bill. Andy Fisher says, Dear J. Lou, I ain't a Judas. What a terrific episode. So many big ideas and so well written and acted. And the look of the show, dirty, sweaty, stinky prison. Watching season 3, I'm totally sold that they're in about the worst place on earth and not on some fake movie lot. Well, that's good because it is a fake movie lot. I ain't no Judas equals trust and betrayal. And in the Walking Dead universe, an error in trust or betrayal can lead to death. I love the way Michonne watches everyone. The conflict of Merle versus the world. Can you trust an enemy of your enemy? Can Andrea be forgiven or trusted? Can Rick trust himself again? Can Rick be trusted by his friends? Yeah, I think it's a lot about trust. Who do you trust to be in your circle of your chosen family? This episode reminds me of what Peter Jackson said about directing the movie The Two Towers. At the end of The Two Towers, there's a huge battle. Peter Jackson said that what makes the battle work in part is the long buildup to it as the orcs slowly approach. The lead up to the battle reminds me of these episodes of The Walking Dead as the heroes wait for the governor to attack and eventually destroy their prison home. Yeah, that's sort of became a pattern in The Walking Dead that maybe got a little tedious after a while. But at this point, I think it was still pretty exciting. I love watching the heroes trying to get ready for the fight and figuring out the best way to survive. Finding the best way to live when you don't know how much longer that is going to be. Finding the best way to talk to your friends. Finding the best way to work it out with your enemies. Five pizzas and a ring. Thanks, Andy. All right, one more call, and it's from Renee.
Guys, this is Renee calling in about The Walking Dead. First, I want to say something to Claire that called in. She was saying that she was having a really, you know, hard time, and it was hard for her to communicate about the stuff that she has been dealing with. Claire, listen, sweetie, one thing about it, trouble don't last always. You're going to get through this, and I'm with you. This podcast helps me to deal with the trauma that goes on in my life as well. So we're family here, And I'm going to make sure I put you on my prayer list. I will be praying for you and whatever it is that you're dealing with, that you're able to overcome it. And then to Chantel, thanks for sharing that little tidbit about Dr. Stevens being Mr. Abernathy's daughter. And of course, hey, I live here in Georgia, so you know, Ralph David Abernathy, that's a main street here. We love him, you know, we honor him. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. And she's one of the ones I was like, why is that lady hair looking like that? Dr. Stevens, I don't like it. And I did not share this little tidbit with you guys. I'm a hairstylist. So if you hear me talking about hair, that is the reason why.
Like, I need your help.
My eyes, I don't care what I'm watching, what I'm doing, my eyes go directly to hair. And also to the young lady, Carissa, thank you so much for saying that you enjoy my feedback. That made me feel really good. I enjoy you guys' feedback as well. I'm telling you, this podcast really helps me, like I told Claire, to deal with a lot of things that I'm going through. This is like my, you guys are like my comfort. The gym, church, and listening to the podcast really helps me to get through. It really does. It helps me to know that there are still some good, wonderful, wholesome people out there in the world. And then Teach, I agree with you when you were saying that about Glenn and how Glenn was, I guess, oblivious. I'm not going to say oblivious. I guess he don't know. He just don't understand. You being hard on Glenn, you were like, people have a problem with, you know, you speaking out, saying bad things about Glenn. So that allows me to sage way into what I'm going to say about Jason. Let me tell you something. Do not play with Jason, okay? Jason don't mean no harm. He don't bother anyone. So for someone to get offended because and feel like he's being racist, I'm sorry, Jason. You know, I talk like I'm talking to always talking to third person. So let me speak directly to you, Jason. If anyone can listen to your podcast and feel like that you're racist, that's a them issue. They're the one that has a problem because clearly you're not racist. Lucy's not racist. I feel like you guys go out of your way to make sure that everyone feels welcome and inviting. You guys go out of your way to make your Black listeners feel comfortable. Like I said the other week, the way that Lucy articulated that about the two walkers being in chain, I could never have done it as well and as eloquently as she did. So that right there shows you that she has empathy. Jason has empathy. Jason is always playing the devil's advocate. So again, Jason, listen, forget about them people. Because what I have realized, like Clarissa was saying, that we tend to make things about racism when it's not about racism at all. And like I was saying with Teague, it's okay for him to say something about Glenn and Glenn being Asian. I mean, he's not saying anything about Glenn because he's Asian. He's saying that this man, it does not matter what color he is, whether he's Black, white, purple, brown, green, or yellow, that this man did not understand. And he's trying to articulate how he feels that Glenn was feeling. Just like Jason was trying to articulate how he felt like Rick's mouth was wide open and he just did not like the scene. He wanted to be more romantic. It had nothing to do with color. I mean, racism does exist, but do not make everything about race because it's not about race. And again, Jason, they can kick rocks. It's their loss. The only about y'all business. Y'all ain't welcome over here anyway if y'all want to act like ducks and feel that you guys could be racist. So no, you're not going to mess with Jason. You're going to go on about your business. Cause let me tell you something. I nook if you book. That's my personality. You ain't going to mess with nobody that I care about. Okay. I don't went on too
Thank
long.
You.
Okay. This episode, I forgot to talk about what happened last week. And so I definitely want to talk about how when Rick was looking out of his binoculars and he looked out there and he saw Michonne, they cut directly to Laurie, the ghost Laurie. That had to be planned. I feel like them people played in our face the whole time. Now, it could have been because Andrew Lincoln did say that when him and Michonne and Merle and all of them was in the woods and the very first time that they all were together, and after they left from fighting the governor, that he, when him and Michonne looked at each other, it felt like it was just dim in the room. So maybe that was when they decided that they were going to put Rick and Michonne together. But I don't believe it. I believe they have been playing in our face. And the whole time, since the very beginning of the very first episode, it was going to make Rick and Michonne Adam. Because Rick needs someone that's non-judgmental. I feel like that Michonne does not judge Rick. That whatever Rick has done, she has always been right there beside him. And that is the type of woman that Rick needed. And that damn Andrea, I was so happy when Rick snatched that damn Green Cross body purse from around her. I'm sick of her damn Green Cross body purse. She irks my soul. And see, I'm talking about a white woman. I don't care about her color. I don't give a damn. Because like I said a couple of episodes back, I loved Sasha at first when I met her. But once she backed old Rosita, she can kick rocks as well. Just like how I feel about her, like I feel about Lori. I stopped liking Sasha when she did that. Because for me, Maggie, Michonne, and Rosita are my favorite characters ever in The Walking Dead. Female characters, of course, everyone know I love Rick Grimes. That is my boo. So, but female characters, I love them. Andrea is oblivious. Like she, I don't understand her. Even when Carol was telling her about Rick killing Shane, and she's like, oh, Shane loved Rick. Carol like, and Shane loved Lori. Like, girl, what the hell are you talking about? Girl, go sit down somewhere. It's like, Andrea, you just act like you lost. And I was so happy when Michonne said that you traded a friend for a warm bed. I don't care. I don't care. I just feel like she should have had Michonne back. I'm going to die on this hill. I'm telling you right now. And I know I have went on too long, so maybe next week I get to tell you about everything else I have wrote down. I just need to get that off my chest. I love you guys. You guys are the best ever. And I love all of the people that's on the podcast. I think that we are a wonderful little group. And only on The Walking Dead would you run toward the love of your life and she pick up the sword as if she's going to kill you. Peace and love. Bye.
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 Thanks, Renee.
Renee, I love your messages. I always look forward to them.
Yay. I can't wait to hear what you say about the next one with Morgan and Clear. That'll be good.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for the encouragement about that stuff about racism and everything. And I don't blame people for being suspicious because you guys have to put up with so much bullshit, but I appreciate it, Renee. All right. That is our show, episode 597. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Thank you, Rachel. That was fun.
Thank you so much. Such an honor. Yeah, oh my gosh. Great. Just like the joy of my life.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Next episode will be The Walking Dead, season 3, episode 12. Clear, a big one. That's going to be, it really stands out, I know, because it's so good. But also, I think because it's somewhere else, too. It's a little bit of a break from the monotony.
A mix up.
Yeah. But it's so great. I can't wait to talk about it. It's going to be me and Lucy and Peter, who asked to be on this one a long time ago. So we'll
awesome.
Have
them
on. Yeah.
If you want to write in or leave us a voice message about it, you can find all our contact information at podcastica.com.
And while you're there, please check out our other podcasts. One that's, I think I mentioned recently, but it's going strong right now, is The Cast of the Rings, about the Rings of Power on Amazon. So you should check that out with Anne Wynn, who's from New Zealand and has this great New Zealand accent. And she used to do tours of Lord of the Rings sites and everything.
Oh yeah.
And Penny's on there with her, and they're a great team. Yeah. And this, I probably shouldn't even bother mentioning this right now, but I've been waiting for this alien TV series for a long time.
Yeah.
Noah Hawley is the showrunner, and he also wrote and directed the Fargo series on TV and Legion, two favorite shows.
Oh my god, I love Legion.
Yeah, and he's like the auteur behind that, and now he's in charge of Aliens, so I can't wait.
Oh my gosh, okay.
So I'm hoping to be able to podcast on that. It's not coming out until next year, or we don't even know when, but I already have a crew who's down to do it, as long as I'm a little worried that all the shows I podcast on are going to drop at exactly the same time, and I won't be able to do them all, but hoping to. So the reason I'm bringing that up is they just put out like a little teaser for it. Finally, it's called Alien Earth. They give it.
Yeah, I saw you posted it, and I just now I'll go watch it.
And it didn't really show much, but it's exciting anyway. This episode is made possible by Patreon supporters like Ian Davies, who pledged their support at patreon.com/JasonCavassi. So thank you to Ian. We do call-in shows every month or two, and this month I feel like we need some... Well, no, that's not the right way to frame it. I've just been feeling in a good mood lately, and so I thought, let's do a call-in show where we talk about what's going well for us right now, what some great things are. So we'll all take turns talking about that. Yeah, it's kind of spread the positivity around. Corny, but fun. Yeah. All right, that is our show.
Thanks for listening.
Don't get bit, Carissa from Portland.